Chapter 22, Moses, the leader of God's people. On account of the service that Joseph had rendered the Egyptian nation, the children of Jacob were not only granted a part of the country as a home but were exempted from taxation and liberally supplied with food during the famine. The king publicly acknowledged that it was through the God of Joseph that Egypt enjoyed plenty while other nations were perishing from famine. He saw, too, that Joseph's management had greatly enriched the kingdom, and his gratitude surrounded the family of Jacob with royal favor. But as time rolled on, the great man to whom Egypt owed so much passed to the grave. And there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. Not that he was ignorant of Joseph's services to the nation, but he wished to make no recognition of them, and, so far as possible, to bury them in oblivion. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass, that, when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies, and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. The Israelites already were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. But they had kept themselves a distinct race, having nothing in common with the Egyptians in customs or religion, and their increasing numbers now excited the fears of the king and his people. Many of them were able and understanding workmen, and they added greatly to the wealth of the nation. The king needed such laborers for the erection of his magnificent palaces and temples. Accordingly, he ranked them with the Egyptians who had sold themselves with their possessions to the kingdom. Soon taskmasters were set over them, and their slavery became complete. The Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. The king and his counselors had hoped to subdue the Israelites with hard labor, decrease their numbers, and crush out their independent spirit. Orders were now issued to the women whose employment gave them opportunity to destroy the Hebrew male children at their birth. Satan knew that a deliverer was to be raised up among the Israelites, and by leading the king to destroy their children he hoped to defeat the divine purpose. But the women feared God and dared not execute the cruel mandate. The king, angry at the failure of his design, made the command more urgent and extensive. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. Moses born in the worst of times. While this decree was in full force, a son was born to Amram and Jochebed, Israelites of the tribe of Levi. The parents, believing that the time of Israel's release was drawing near and that God would raise up a deliverer for his people, determined that their little one should not be sacrificed. Faith in God strengthened their hearts, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. The mother concealed the child for 3 months. Then, finding that she could no longer keep him safely, she prepared a little ark of rushes, making it watertight by means of slime and pitch, and, laying the babe therein, she placed it among the flags at the river's brink. His sister Miriam lingered near, anxiously watching to see what would become of her little brother. And there were other watchers. The mother had committed her child to the care of God, and angels, unseen, hovered above his lowly resting place. Angels directed Pharaoh's daughter thither. Her curiosity was excited by the little basket, and as she looked upon the beautiful child within, the tears of the babe awakened her compassion. Her sympathies went out to the unknown mother who had resorted to this means to preserve her precious little one. She determined that he should be saved, she would adopt him as her own. Miriam, perceiving that the child was tenderly regarded, ventured nearer, and at last said, Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? Permission was given. The sister hastened to her mother with the happy news, and without delay returned with her to the presence of Pharaoh's daughter. "Take this child away, and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages," said the princess. 12 short years. God had heard the mother's prayer. With deep gratitude she entered upon her now safe and happy task, to educate her child for God. She knew that he must soon be given up to his royal mother, to be surrounded with influences that would tend to lead him away from God. She endeavored to imbue his mind with the fear of God and the love of truth and justice. She showed him the folly and sin of idolatry and early taught him to bow down and pray to the living God, who alone could hear him and help him in every emergency. She kept the boy as long as she could but was obliged to give him up when he was about 12 years old. From his humble cabin home he was taken to the royal palace, to the daughter of Pharaoh, and he became her son. Yet even here the lessons learned at his mother's side could not be forgotten. They were a shield from the pride, the infidelity, and the vice that flourished amid the splendor of the court. The whole future life of Moses, the great mission which he fulfilled as the leader of Israel, testifies to the importance of the work of the mother. There is no other work that can equal this. The mother is dealing with developing minds and characters, working not alone for time, but for eternity. She is sowing seed that will spring up and bear fruit, either for good or for evil. She has not to paint a form of beauty upon canvas or to chisel it from marble, but to impress upon the human soul the image of the divine. The impressions made upon developing minds will remain all through life. Children are placed in our care to be trained, not as heirs to the throne of an earthly empire, but as kings unto God, to reign through unending ages. In the solemn day of accounts it will be found that many crimes have resulted from the ignorance and neglect of those whose duty it was to guide childish feet in the right way. Then it will be found that many who have blessed the world with the light of genius and truth and holiness owe their success to a praying mother. At the court of Pharaoh, Moses received the highest civil and military training. The monarch determined to make his adopted grandson his successor on the throne, and the youth was educated for his high station. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. His ability as a military leader made him a favorite with the armies of Egypt, and he was generally regarded as a remarkable character. Satan had been defeated in his purpose. The very decree condemning the Hebrew children to death had been overruled by God for the training of the future leader of his people. The elders of Israel were taught by angels that the time for their deliverance was near and that Moses was the man whom God would employ. Angels instructed Moses also that Jehovah had chosen him to break the bondage of his people. He, supposing they were to obtain their freedom by arms, expected to lead the Hebrew host against the armies of Egypt. How young Moses was tested. By the laws of Egypt, all who occupied the throne of the pharaohs must become members of the priestly caste. Moses, as the heir apparent, was to be initiated into the mysteries of the national religion. But he could not be induced to participate in the worship of the gods. He was threatened with the loss of the crown and warned that he would be disowned by the princess should he persist in the Hebrew faith. But he was unshaken in his determination to render homage to none save the one God, the maker of heaven and earth. He reasoned with priests and worshippers, showing the folly of their superstitious veneration of senseless objects. For the time his firmness was tolerated on account of his high position and the favor with which he was regarded by both the king and the people. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God, than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Moses was fitted to take preeminence among the great of the earth, to shine in the courts of its most glorious kingdom, and to sway the scepter of its power. As historian, poet, philosopher, general of armies, and legislator, he stands without a peer. Yet with the world before him, he had the moral strength to refuse wealth, greatness, and fame, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. The magnificent palace of Pharaoh and the throne were held out as an inducement to Moses, but he knew that the sinful pleasures that make men forget God were in its lordly courts. He looked beyond the palace, beyond a monarch's crown, to the high honors that will be bestowed on the saints of the Most High in a kingdom untainted by sin. He saw by faith an imperishable crown that the King of Heaven would place on the brow of the overcomer. This faith led him to join the humble, poor, despised nation that had chosen to obey God rather than to serve sin. Moses remained at court until he was 40. He visited his brethren in their servitude and encouraged them with the assurance that God would work for their deliverance. One day, seeing an Egyptian smiting an Israelite, he sprang forward and slew the Egyptian. Except the Israelite, there had been no witness to the deed, and Moses immediately buried the body in the sand. He had now shown himself ready to maintain the cause of his people, and he hoped to see them rise to recover their liberty. He supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. They were not yet prepared for freedom. On the following day Moses saw two Hebrews striving together, one of them evidently at fault. Moses reproved the offender, who at once retaliated upon the reprover, denying his right to interfere and basely accusing him of crime, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us?" he said. "Intendest thou to kill me, as thou killedst the Egyptian?" The whole matter soon reached the ears of Pharaoh. It was represented to the king that this act meant much, that Moses designed to lead his people against the Egyptians, to overthrow the government, and to seat himself upon the throne. It was at once determined by the monarch that he should die, but becoming aware of his danger, Moses fled toward Arabia. The Lord directed his course, and he found a home, with Jethro, the priest and prince of Midian, who was a worshipper of God. After a time Moses married one of the daughters of Jethro, and here, as keeper of his flocks, he remained 40 years. It was not God's will to deliver his people by warfare, as Moses thought, but by his own mighty power, that the glory might be ascribed to him alone. Moses was not prepared for his great work. He had yet to learn the same lesson of faith that Abraham and Jacob had been taught, not to rely upon human strength or wisdom but upon the power of God for the fulfillment of his promises. In the school of self-denial and hardship he was to learn patience, to temper his passions. His own heart must be fully in harmony with God before he could teach the knowledge of his will to Israel and exercise a fatherly care over all who needed his help. Doing God's work the wrong way. Moses had been learning much that he must unlearn. The influences that had surrounded him in Egypt had left deep impressions upon his developing mind and had molded to some extent his habits and character. Time could remove these impressions. It would require on the part of Moses himself a struggle as for life to renounce error and accept truth, but God would be his helper when the conflict should be too severe for human strength. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. But God will not impart to men divine light while they are content to remain in darkness. In order to receive God's help, man must realize his weakness and deficiency, he must apply his own mind to the great change to be wrought in himself, he must be aroused to earnest and persevering prayer and effort. Shut in by the bulwarks of the mountains, Moses was alone with God. In the solemn grandeur of the everlasting hills he beheld the majesty of the Most High, and in contrast realized how powerless were the gods of Egypt. Here his pride and self-sufficiency were swept away. The results of the luxury of Egypt disappeared. Moses became patient, reverent, and humble, very meek, above all the men which were upon the face of the earth, yet strong in faith. As the years rolled on, his prayers for Israel ascended by day and by night. Here, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he wrote the book of Genesis. The long years spent amid the desert solitudes were rich in blessing to the world in all ages. The time for freedom comes. In process of time, the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God, and God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. The time for deliverance had come. God's purpose was to be accomplished in a manner to pour contempt on human pride. The deliverer was to go forth as a humble shepherd, with only a rod in his hand, but God would make that rod the symbol of his power. Leading his flocks one day near Horeb, the mountain of God, Moses saw a bush in flames, yet not consumed. He drew near, when a voice from out of the flame called him by name. With trembling lips he answered, "Here am I." He was warned not to approach irreverently, "Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. As Moses waited in awe before God, the words continued, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of the land unto a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. Come now therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people the children of Israel out of Egypt." Amazed and terrified, Moses drew back, saying, "Who am I, that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" Moses thought of the blindness, ignorance, and unbelief of his people. Many were almost destitute of a knowledge of God. "Behold," he said, "when I shall say unto them, The God of your fathers hath sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them?" The answer was, "I am that I am, I am hath sent me unto you." Moses was commanded first to assemble the elders of Israel who had long grieved because of their bondage and to declare to them a message from God. Then he was to go before the king, and say, "The Lord God of the Hebrews hath met with us, and now let us go, we beseech thee, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God." Moses was forewarned that Pharaoh would resist the appeal. Yet the courage of God's servant must not fail. The Lord would manifest his power. "And I will stretch out my hand, and smite Egypt with all my wonders which I will do in the midst thereof, and after that he will let you go." The Lord declared, "It shall come to pass, that, when ye go, ye shall not go empty, but every woman shall borrow of her neighbor, and of her that sojourneth in her house, jewels of silver, and jewels of gold, and raiment." The Egyptians had been enriched by the labor unjustly exacted from the Israelites, and it was right for the latter to claim the reward of their years of toil. God would give them favor in the sight of the Egyptians. The requests of the bondmen would be granted. What proof could Moses give his people that God had indeed sent him? "Behold," he said, "they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, The Lord hath not appeared unto thee." He was told to cast his rod upon the ground. As he did so, it became a serpent, and Moses fled from before it. He was commanded to seize it, and in his hand it became a rod. He was bidden to put his hand into his bosom. He obeyed, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous as snow. Being told to put it again into his bosom, he found on withdrawing it that it had become like the other. By these signs his own people, as well as Pharaoh, would be convinced that one mightier than the king of Egypt was manifest among them. Moses is reluctant. But in his distress and fear the servant of God now pleaded as an excuse a lack of ready speech, "O my Lord, I am not eloquent, I am slow of speech, and of a slow tongue." He had been so long away from the Egyptians that he had not so ready use of their language as when he was among them. Moses entreated that a more competent person be selected. But after the Lord had promised to remove all difficulties and give him final success, any further complaining of his unfitness showed distrust of God. It implied a fear that God was unable to qualify him or that he had made a mistake in the selection of the man. Aaron, his elder brother, having been in daily use of the language of the Egyptians, was able to speak it perfectly. He was told that Aaron was coming to meet him. The next words from the Lord were an unqualified command. "Thou shalt speak unto him, and put words in his mouth, and he shall be thy spokesman unto the people, and he shall be, even he shall be to thee instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of God. And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand, wherewith thou shalt do signs." He could make no further resistance, for all ground for excuse was removed. Having once accepted the work, Moses entered upon it with his whole heart, putting all his trust in the Lord. God blessed his ready obedience, and he became eloquent, hopeful, self-possessed, and well-fitted for the greatest work ever given to man. A man will gain power and efficiency as he accepts the responsibilities that God places upon him. However humble his position or limited his ability, that man will attain true greatness who seeks to perform his work with fidelity. The fact that a man feels his weakness is at least some evidence that he realizes the magnitude of the work appointed him. He will make God his counselor and his strength. A secret dread of Pharaoh and the Egyptians, whose anger had been kindled against him 40 years before, had rendered Moses reluctant to return to Egypt, but after he had set out to obey the divine command, the Lord revealed to him that his enemies were dead. On the way from Midian, an angel appeared to Moses in a threatening manner, as if he would destroy him. No explanation was given, but Moses remembered that he had disregarded one of God's requirements. He had neglected to perform the rite of circumcision upon their youngest son. Such a neglect on the part of Israel's chosen leader could not but lessen the force of the divine precepts upon the people. Zipporah, fearing that her husband would be slain, performed the rite herself, and the angel then permitted Moses to pursue his journey. His life could be preserved only through the protection of holy angels. But while living in neglect of a known duty, he would not be secure, for he could not be shielded by the angels of God. In the time of trouble just before the coming of Christ, the righteous will be preserved through the ministrations of angels, but there will be no security for the transgressor of God's law. Angels cannot protect those who are disregarding one of the divine precepts.